Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Greetings. Welcome to...
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
At a hearing of the House Subcommittee on Telecommunications and the Internet last week, members of Congress from both sides of the aisle spoke of the need to loosen the grip of phone companies on wireless devices and applications. Users of the iPhone, for instance, must sign an exclusive contract with AT&T.
The iPhone highlights both the promise and the problems of the wireless industry today.
That's subcommittee chairman Edward Markey, the Democrat from Massachusetts.
The advent of the iPhone raises questions about the fact that a consumer can't use this phone with other wireless carriers, and that consumers in some areas of the country where AT&T doesn't provide service, that they can't use it in some neighborhoods at all.
Mississippi Republican Chip Pickering also said the convergence of video, voice, and the Internet needs a new policy that fosters a competitive wholesale marketplace.
Openness is creating a wholesale market. It is creating interoperability for devices so that you can use a device, whether it's an iPhone or another device, with whatever function you choose.
According to Columbia Law Professor Timothy Wu, the rules of the wireless road are going to have to change much more drastically if the United States wants to lead the global wireless industry.
We have allowed a spectrum-based oligopoly in wireless that is controlling innovation and is controlling the development of devices in the wireless sector.
The co-founder and CEO of Skydeck, a Silicon Valley wireless services company, agreed. Jason Devitt said, "We always have regulations, but we must choose between badly written policies and regulations that work. The present regulatory system doesn't work," he says, "because it isn't open to innovation."
I'm an entrepreneur, and I'm mad as hell that I require permission to innovate in the wireless market. I don't have to go to the companies, the great companies that build our public highways, and ask them for their views on what kind of cars that I can put on those roads. But for some reason I've never been able to understand, I have to ask permission of Verizon Wireless to attach a computer, or the computers that they now call phones, to their wireless network, and I have to ask their permission to run applications and services on those phones.
Representative John Dingell, the chairman of the House Commerce Committee, echoed the calls for greater consumer choice.
The purpose here is to provide service to the consumers. The purpose here is to provide competition so that the consumers are best served. And once we agree on all of those points, why is it that we should not allow this particular choice to the consumer? And why is it that right to choose by the consumer should be constrained?
For more information about the iPhone hearing and what you can do to ensure wireless freedom, go to freetheiphone.org.
Customers subscribing to Verizon's high-speed Fios system have been cut off from other broadband, phone, and television options. Literally, when the telecom giant installs new fiber optic cable to a customer's home or business, it has been pulling out the existing copper wiring used for traditional communications lines. although fiber optic lines are faster than traditional copper wires, there are some potential problems with doing away with the copper completely. For instance, Fios service is lost during a power outage, not so with the old copper wire service. And if you find you'd rather sacrifice some speed for a smaller monthly bill, you're out of luck. DSL only works with copper wire. What's more, some devices, like home alarms, were designed to work with copper. And once you install Fios, there's no turning back or changing over to a cheaper alternative without the expense of rewiring your home or business. Verizon says that customers have been properly notified that their copper wire would be disconnected, but some customers say the notification was buried in paragraphs of small print that is typical of service contracts. Some think Verizon has another reason to yank the copper, to retire the competition as they retire the wires. Under the law, phone companies like Verizon must lease their copper wires to their rivals, but the law doesn't apply to new fiber systems, and that will leave smaller internet providers with little hope of competing, and consumers fewer choices for their broadband, telephone, and cable service.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at www.freepress.net.
You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM from Urbana, Illinois. Unfortunately, due to technical difficulties, we're unable to go to our scheduled live broadcast with Bob McChesney this week. So we're going to take a show from the Media Matters archives. This is a show with Noam Chomsky from March of 2006.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live on WILL AM 580. This December 3rd, 2006, I'm coming from the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and going out to not only the local denizens of the region, but to the people of the rural, courtesy of podcasting. Today, a guest that we've loved to have on the show, we've had several times, and he's very graciously agreed to join us today, someone who I think needs almost no introduction to anyone who listens to this show or just about anyone who cares about politics in this country. Our guest, Noam Chomsky, calling in or talking to us from his home in Massachusetts. Noam, are you there?
Yes, I am. Glad to be with you again.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here. It's an honor to have you as well. And there's so much to talk about. Let's start, if we can, with the Middle East. Since we were last...
Nice, easy place.
Yeah. Well, I know you've been writing about it quite a bit recently. You have a new book out on it. And, you know, since we've had the, you know, war of the past, of this year, the breakout of the war. What is your assessment now of the situation with Israel and Palestine and the role of the United States? And what has changed in the last year, if anything?
What's changed is it's gotten much worse. We're actually witnessing, right before our eyes, a rare event in history, the death of a nation. It's what Israeli sociologist Baruch Kimmerling called politicide a few years ago. Which makes it sound a little too bloodless and cold, though he didn't mean it that way. The latest stage began in January of this year. The Palestinians committed a major crime in January. There was a free election, closely monitored, declared to be free and fair, and they voted the wrong way. That is absolutely criminal. And the U.S. and Israel immediately demonstrated the absolutely passionate hatred for democracy that prevails in both countries. It's dramatic here. And immediately turned to punishing the population severely for having voted the wrong way in a free election. It wasn't even concealed. In fact, it was kind of astonishing to read the press. One day, I think it was maybe February 12th, The New York Times had a book review by Noah Feldman, the NYU law professor who sort of famous for trying to foist the Constitution down on Iraq, which they refused. He had a review of a book by Osama bin Laden, a collection of his statements. And, of course, it was condemning at the beginning. He described how Osama began with being awful and gradually descended to the utter depths of depravity when he finally took the position that the people of the United States are responsible for the actions of the government, so therefore they're fair targets. How can you get lower than that? 2 days later, the lead story in the New York Times, I think it was Stephen Erlanger, described calmly that the United States and Israel are going to the lowest depths of depravity. Now, that is, they're responding to the election by severely punishing the people of Palestine for the crime of voting the wrong way. And they did. Very harsh sanctions, increase in Israel's military attacks. They even cut off the water from the Gaza Strip. That's a water-scarce area, act of kind of extra savagery. Closed the closings, and so it went on. Europe joined in. As always, Europe kind of tails along politely when the master speaks. And it's just picked up since then. By June, there were Israeli bombings and so on had increased pretty sharply. But then in June 25th came a major escalation. That you read about all over the press. On June 25th, militants in Gaza captured an Israeli soldier, Corporal Gilad Shalit. Whatever crime you think it is to capture the soldier of an occupying army, okay, so it was a crime. The West was utterly outraged by this crime. Israel immediately, sharply stepped up its attacks in Gaza. The number of people killed the next month quadrupled. Attacked the power station, you know, eliminating electrical supply, water, and so on. The U.S. Joined in totally. I mean, the American media, again, were totally outraged. All total hypocrisy. And they all knew it. I mean, one day earlier, June 24th, Israeli forces had illegally entered Gaza and kidnapped two civilians, the Muammar brothers, a doctor and his brother, and taken them to Israel in violation of the Geneva Conventions, of course, where they disappeared into the prison system, joining maybe 800 or 900 others who were held without trial, hence essentially kidnapped. Well, you know, kidnapping civilians is a far worse crime than capturing a soldier, by any measure. And it was known. I mean, if you look, I actually had a friend who, you know, David Peterson, do a media search on it, and he found a fair number of reports, like, you know, 87 words in the Washington Post, a couple of words here and there, basically repeating IDF handouts, Israeli Army handouts. I mean, there's no secret about it. But nobody cares. You know, it's fine. When they do something to us, the sky falls in. When we do something much worse to them, it didn't even happen. Nobody called for attacking Israel. Furthermore, it's not the first time. It goes on all the time. Maybe that's a reason not to report it.
Well,
okay.
No.
And it just gets worse after that.
Yeah, you started this discussion of Israel and Palestine by talking about what you called politicide, the end of a nation, referring to Palestine. Is there any possible way to have peace in the Middle East?
Yeah, it's easy. Everybody knows the way. I only mentioned, I don't want to spend too much time.
Actually, I meant peace if you got rid of Palestine. I mean, is that any viable?
Well, one peace, one way of, you know, there's always the peace of the graveyard. That's one way. I didn't mention what was happening in the West Bank. I'll just say a word about that. I think it was March, Ehud Olmert, Prime Minister, announced his program of what's called convergence. That was hailed in the United States and most of Europe as very forthcoming and moderate and so on, because he was withdrawing from a few scattered illegal settlements. It was an outrageous program. It was a program of annexation, dismemberment, and imprisonment in the West Bank. It was annexation of some of the most valuable land, the major resources, water, all to be annexed to Israel. Dismemberment of whatever is left to Palestine by infrastructure projects, settlements that, you know, cut right through the territory and so on. And imprisonment because Israel takes over the Jordan Valley. That's what was called the Great Forthcoming Moderate Initiative, authorized, of course, by George Bush and supported by the media. It's a wonderful thing. It shows how marvelous he is. And now he's sort of withdrawn it, so there's great disturbance that he can no longer pursue these moderate programs. Well, that's politicide. That's a killing of a nation, and we're doing it, of course. Is there a solution? Sure. Everyone knows what it is. There's been a solution on the table for over 30 years, a two-state settlement on the international border, pre-June 67 border, with minor and mutual adjustments. That was the official U.S. stand up until 1971. So I'll quote that. And it's pretty much the world's stand. Who's in favor of it? Well, the only people in favor of it for the last 30 years are practically the whole world. Right now and for a long time, in favor of it is the Palestinians, the Arab states, Europe, Iran, which has stated officially, though I don't think it's been reported here, that Iran accepts the position of the Arab League, namely for full normalization of relations with Israel within a settlement of this kind. Hezbollah in Lebanon accepts it. They don't like it, but they say if that's what the Palestinians want, we accept it. Hamas has indicated that they accept it. All that's left is Israel and the United States, which continue to reject it, as they have been doing for 30 years. 30 years of almost invariant rejectionism. I say almost because, to be precise, there was 1 week in January 2001 when there were negotiations. It's Clinton's last month and Barack's. There were negotiations in Taba, Egypt, between Israeli and Palestinian negotiators, and they came fairly close to a settlement in these terms. Not quite, but close. Close enough so that in their final meeting, they had a press conference and said, if we had a little more time, we think we could wrap this up. Well, there wasn't a little more time. Israeli Prime Minister Barak called off the negotiations a couple of days early. U.S. sat by quietly. 2 weeks later came elections in Israel. Sharon was elected. Bush is elected here. And they just went on to expand it. All of this goes on step by step alongside of awe about the noble messianic vision of George Bush to bring democracy and freedom to the Middle East, his vision of a two-state settlement, which he's destroying. If someone was watching this from Mars, they'd think we're insane.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics at MIT, common writer on politics. Common isn't the right word, but frequent writer on politics, international relations, and media. Well known, I think, to all our listeners. He's joining us live from Massachusetts. Anyone who'd like to call Media Matters, the phone number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. My name is Bob McChesney, and this is WILL AM 580 in Urbana, Illinois. Now, I'd like to turn to another corner of the Middle East, Iraq, which obviously is a huge story around the world. And, you know, what I'd like you to do, if you wouldn't mind, is just you were very active in the Vietnam era, opposing the U.S. Invasion and war in Vietnam. And a lot of people are comparing Iraq to Vietnam today and have been, I think, for some time. I was wondering if you would just give me your thoughts on how what's happening in Iraq compares to what's happening in Vietnam for the United States and for the world.
Well, I think it's a very misleading comparison. I mean, there are some points of similarity. One point of similarity is the criticism. I mean, I don't mean you and me and activists and so on, but I mean the dominant criticism in the mainstream, and even over towards, you know, sort of the left liberal criticism. It's very similar to what it was in Vietnam. In Vietnam, after about 6 or 7 years of war, there did emerge a critical current in the mainstream. I mean, you got, say, Anthony Lewis in the New York Times saying the war began with benign intentions to do good, but by 1969 it's clear that it was a disastrous mistake, which is costing us too much, and so on. That was kind of the left end of the permissible criticism, articulate criticism. And it's pretty much the same now. You read the critical commentary on the war now in the left liberal journals by nice people. You know, I like the people. That's about what it is. It's a terrible catastrophe. It's costing us too much. We're in a quagmire. Got to get out of it, and so on. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is that in both cases, it was outright aggression, the supreme international crime for which Nazi war criminals were hanged. In both cases, it was devastating to the population. In Indochina, it was Kennedy who invaded in 1962. There had been atrocities before, but not an outright invasion. By the time the war was over, millions of people had been killed, four countries had been destroyed, beyond the point, you know, of any meaningful recovery for most of them. And in Iraq, it's not that long a war, but the results are horrendous. Iraq is a dying country. Just this morning you could read that the estimates of people who've fled are about 1.5 million, and there's probably that many inside trying to get out. Number of reasonable calculation of the number of deaths is surely in the hundreds of thousands. A major Lancet report estimates 650,000, plus or minus. Countries devastated, may never come back together again. But that's not what's being discussed. However, turning to the differences, there are differences. The crucial, and in order to see them, we have to extricate ourselves from a lot of doctrinal obfuscation. And I'm afraid this includes the left, too, to a large extent. But let's just take a look at what the wars were about in the two cases. In the case of Vietnam, by the late 60s, there was already ample documentary evidence, and there was a lot more later, that the reason for the invasion of Vietnam was the conventional one. To borrow Kissinger's terms for Allende, general terms, there was a fear that Vietnam would be a virus that would spread contagion elsewhere. That's the sensible form of the domino theory, not the form for public consumption. What it means is that there was a threat of successful independent development in ways that would be meaningful for others who suffer from similar problems. And that might spread the contagion. It might spread it to Thailand and on, maybe even to Indonesia, which was a real prize, and where the U.S. had, in fact, just tried to overthrow the government, supporting a military coup. And if that happened, the U.S. could lose its global position in Asia. Japan might accommodate itself, as they put it, to an independent Asian mainland that would, in effect, reconstruct something like the new order that Japan was trying to construct in World War II by violence. And the U.S. was just not willing to lose World War II in the Pacific in the early 1960s. So they invaded South Vietnam. And, in fact, the war aims were achieved. By the late 60s, the virus had been destroyed. There was never going to be any successful development in Vietnam. It'd be likely, if lucky, if it could survive. And the region had been inoculated from the infection. There were murderous dictatorships established in the countries all around, the most important, Indonesia. There was the Suharto coup took place in 1965, destroyed the only mass-based political party, a party of the poor, killed nobody knows how many, maybe hundreds of thousands, maybe 1 million people, mostly landless peasants. Brutal violence opened the country up to investors, U.S., Canadian, others. So it was a dream. And there was no, the war aims were essentially met. It was a victory. It wasn't a total victory. The U.S. did not achieve its ultimate war aims, establishing a client state in Indochina. But that was a marginal question. It's called a defeat. because unless you win your highest aims, you're defeated. But in fact, the major aims were achieved, and the business press was more or less aware of it. I was writing about it around 1970, I should say. Okay, that's Vietnam. Let's go to Iraq. A completely different situation. You can't destroy Iraq. It's far too valuable. It's the second largest energy reserves in the world, right at the heart of the world's major energy-producing region, which is the reason for the invasion in the first place. If they could have established a client state in Iraq and a base, permanent U.S. military base, which in fact they're still trying to build, military bases, biggest embassy in the world, and so on. I mean, if you do that, it's a tremendous achievement. It extends enormously U.S. control over the world's most crucial region, the center of the world's major energy resources. It's also, as the more astute analysts recognize publicly, like, say, Brzezinski, he wasn't much in favor of the invasion, but he said if it succeeds, it would provide the U.S. with critical leverage over its industrial rivals in Europe and Asia, which is correct. He was echoing words of George Kennan, one of the most important early post-war planners, who said that if we control Middle East oil, we will have veto power over rivals. He's talking specifically about Japan, but the point generalizes. And that's true. It has very little to do with access. In fact, the U.S. was following the same policies when it didn't use a drop of Middle East oil and didn't even think it ever would. And in fact, even right now, its intelligence projections are that the U.S. itself will rely on more secure Atlantic Basin resources, West Africa, Western Hemisphere, but of course will control Middle East oil for the usual reasons. It's a matter of control, not access, very much like the pipeline story about Central Asia. Well, you know, you cannot achieve those goals by destroying Iraq. It's not at all like Vietnam. And in fact, that's a very strong reason why the U.S. is so opposed to any meaningful form of sovereignty and democracy in Iraq, and why there's a pretty much bipartisan consensus that you just can't withdraw. I mean, it's not their concern for the Iraqi people. I mean, that doesn't pass the laugh test. It's concern for the fact that if the U.S. were to withdraw from Iraq and to leave a sovereign, independent, more or less democratic Iraq, you can see clearly what's likely to happen. It could be a nightmare for Washington. There's a Shiite majority. So if it's more or less democratic, they'll be the dominant force. They may not love Iran, but they would much rather have friendly relations with Iran, their Shiite neighbor, than hostile relations. And there indeed are relations which are reasonably close and increasing. One of the main militias in Iraq, the Badr Brigade, was trained in Iran. The Ayatollah Sistani, the most revered cleric, comes from Iran, so do many of the others. They're up and back right now, even making arrangements and so on. That's called Iranian interference in Iraq. I mean, the terminology is mind-boggling. We're occupying Iraq, and we're accusing Iran of interfering by establishing relations with the Iraqi government. Anyway, that's the norm. But that's very likely to happen, and there's much worse. Right across the border in Saudi Arabia, there's a very large Shiite population, probably the majority. They've been harshly repressed by the U.S.-backed tyranny. That's our oldest ally in the region. When the signs of independence in Iraq, even minimal signs, have stimulated autonomy movements and also just movements to gain decent rights, in the Shiite region, which happens to be where most of Saudi oil is. Saudi Arabia is the main reserve of oil. It's sort of the jewel in the crown. That's it's Washington's oldest and most valued ally in the region because that's where the oil is. Well, just think what this means. It could lead to a kind of a loose Shia alliance, controlling most of the world's oil, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Iran, independent of the United States. And then it gets worse, because although Europe can be intimidated and told to keep out, China cannot be intimidated. That's why China is considered such a threat. It's not a military threat. But if you look at the planning documents, China is considered the main potential threat. Good reason. China cannot be intimidated. From their point of view, they've been there for 3,000 years, paying not much attention to the barbarians, and they're not going to start now. So when the U.S. warns people not to invest in Iran, the Europeans pull out, Chinese move in. In fact, we just saw a pretty dramatic, kind of comical example of that a few months ago. The president of China, President Hu, came to Washington this last spring, and the Bush administration decided they wanted to insult him. So they did not grant him a state dinner, the usual, just a state lunch, big insult. He didn't seem to mind very much. He responded politely, and he responded by a slightly bigger insult. He flew from Washington to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, where he very openly entered into new commercial relations. China's a major trading partner with Saudi Arabia, getting a lot of its oil from there. They're beginning to invest. They're even giving them military aid. So he said, basically what he was saying is, fine, you know, I'll pass up the state dinner and I'll take over your prize in the region, which is, you know, the kind of thing that's happening. Well, those are serious issues. Unless those issues are discussed, confronted, talk about withdrawal strategies just doesn't mean a lot. So the comparison with Vietnam, I think, fails very seriously.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Noam Chomsky, talking to us from his home in Massachusetts. My name's Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. This is a live show. We have a full bank of people waiting to talk with Noam Chomsky. I'm going to go to the phone lines now, and I ask all of the callers, make your questions very brief, if you would, as brief as possible, because we have a lot of people who'd like to talk to Professor Chomsky. Line one, Virginia, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Noam Chomsky.
Hello, Professor Chomsky. My name is Sarabjit, and it's a great, great honor to talk to you today. My question is a little off the topic, but not too far from the Middle East region. I mean, I was born and raised in India and have lived my whole life with the constant reminder of the turmoil which is going on in Kashmir for the past 60 years now. So my question is to you is related to that beautiful part of Central Asia, which has been devastated due to a simple land dispute between India and Pakistan. I just wanted to know your input about how much do you think the responsibility lies on the shoulders of Western imperialism and superpower conflicts in Afghanistan for turning this simple land dispute into a more complex conflict with religious overtones, you know, imported from unemployed jihadists which were left out there after Russia pulled out of Afghanistan. And I'll take your answer off the air.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Sergey.
Well, anything that goes on in the world, there's going to be an influence of the major power centers, primarily the United States and others. But my own feeling is that in the case of Kashmir, the responsibility primarily lies in the hands of India and Pakistan. And it's a shared responsibility for violence and atrocities. The terrorist activities, are mostly the ones we call terrorist activities, are coming from Pakistan. The Indian Army there has been extremely brutal and has carried out major atrocities. There are Human Rights Watch reports on these and others. That's particularly true since the, I think it was 1988 election, approximately then, when it was clear that either movements, either pro-Pakistan That stimulated the terrorist actions on both sides, the kind of jihadi-style terrorism based in Pakistan, the Indian Army terrorism. And as you said, it's ruined. It goes back before that. It's ruined a beautiful, delightful country. It used to be the pearl of the region. How can it be solved? Well, I think some of the best proposals were made by my late friend Iqbal Ahmed. They're discussed in his essays, collected essays, were recently published at Columbia University, and he has some discussion of it there. He was originally Indian, Bihari, but grew up in Pakistan. He outlined what seemed to me sensible proposals for sort of effective autonomy within a kind of a shared overall federalist framework. So both Pakistan and India would have a share in supervision, but there would be substantial autonomy for Kashmir. And I think something like that is the best of available answers.
You know, Noam, the caller also mentioned Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And one of the common refrains for the last 2 years in the United States political discourse, in the media and among our politicians, especially coming from Democrats, has been that the White House, the Bush administration, dropped the ball in the just and proper war in Afghanistan, tracking down bin Laden by going off on the war in Iraq, and that we should return to Afghanistan and do the correct liberation of Afghanistan, track down the terrorists, and finish the job there successfully. Does that square with your impression of what's been taking place in Afghanistan?
Very partially. First of all, I think the invasion of Afghanistan was one of the major war crimes. Fortunately, it didn't turn out as horrible as was anticipated, but that's no justification. I mean, you could justify Khrushchev putting missiles in Cuba because it didn't lead to a nuclear war. No argument. The bombing of Afghanistan was undertaken with the expectation that it might drive an additional 2.5 million people over the edge of starvation. There already were 5 million, and the expectations were that as a result of the bombing, it might go up by several million. That's threatening millions of people with death. And in fact, the bombing was bitterly condemned for those reasons by the aid agencies, which had to pull out almost all of them. It was condemned by leading Afghans. I don't think it got reported here. It even partially got reported here, but the U.S. favorite, Abdul Haq, a leading anti-Taliban Afghan, bitterly condemned the bombing. He said the U.S. is just trying to show off its muscle. It doesn't care anything about Afghans. It's undermining our efforts to overthrow the Taliban from within, which was not likely to succeed. There was actually a meeting a couple of weeks later of, I think, 1,000 anti-Taliban Afghans. It was in Pakistan, but a lot of them were trekking over the border from Afghanistan, and that did get publicized. They disagreed about a lot of things, but they were almost unanimous in condemning the bombing. That was about 3 weeks after the bombing. The bombing was undertaken not to overthrow the Taliban. It was undertaken to compel the Taliban to turn over to the United States people who the U.S. suspected of participation in 9/11. I stress suspected. I mean, probably they were responsible, but the U.S. conceded, had no evidence, and conceded that months later. 8 months later, the head of the FBI conceded publicly that they still had, essentially had no evidence. They just believed the plot was hatched in Afghanistan. Now, that was the purpose of the bombing. 3 weeks after the bombing started, there was an official statement, this time by the British, that to the people of Afghanistan, that unless you overthrow the government, you're going to be bombed. That's bin Laden's lowest level of depravity again. Well, that's what happened. Fortunately, and almost miraculously, the worst concerns were not realized, although they kept being voiced. You can read in the leading specialist at Harvard on Afghanistan, even a couple of months later, in the was warning of the in Harvard's major journal of the grave threat of starvation if this goes on. Well, fortunately, the worst didn't happen. After that, it's true that the criticism begins to be true. The U.S. did not put resources, nor did anyone else, into trying to reconstruct the country from the damage, and there are plenty of people responsible for that. Russia, of course, from the invasion of the 1980s, the Reagan administration for creating an Islamic terrorist army, the roots of Al-Qaeda, in the 1980s, not to defend Afghanistan, which would have been legitimate, but for the usual ugly reasons of state, then leaving them there to destroy the country afterwards, country taken over by, hideous warlords who the U.S. had supported, and they practically wrecked what was left. It was so bad that the population welcomed the Taliban when they came in, and the U.S. kind of tolerated the Taliban and then decided to bomb for the reasons I mentioned. Well, there's a lot of responsibility there, others too, to do something about the wreckage that they've left, and it's barely been done. I mean, the country is by now pretty much back in the hand of warlords. There is a government in Kabul, Hamid Karzai is often called the mayor of Kabul, can't really get much outside. Population is surviving on production of poppies, opium. The Taliban had, in fact, ended opium production. Afghanistan had been the main world source of heroin, but now it's built up again. The new figures are astonishing, goes up every year. The Taliban are coming back. There are arrangements being made, informal arrangements between tribal elders, the Taliban, and the government to leave certain regions under the control of the tribes. Helmand Province apparently has such an agreement being made. NATO forces are in there. What the country needs is not more war, but reconstruction. And it looks like just a growing horror. I mean, the question about what should be done, as always, the primary responsibility of everyone is to listen to the voices of the victims. So what do the Afghans want? Well, it's not easy to determine under circumstances like that, but not impossible. And that should provide guidelines as to what is to be done.
Our guest is Noam Chomsky today in Media Matters. We have a couple of callers who've been waiting very patiently. I want to get to them if we can right now. Line 4, Farina, you're on the air with Noam Chomsky.
Hi. It's truly an honor to speak with someone who consistently educates people on the value of deep thought and free speech. And Noam Chomsky, you're great too.
thank you.
I've read a couple of books in the past, The Beast Reawakens and Blowback, about how the Nazi intelligence officers from World War II recruited into the OSS and early CIA, the Nazi influence in the U.S. government seems to follow. I'd like you to comment about this Military Commission Act of 07 that was recently signed, and the fact that the U.S. government seems to be moving towards a Nazi-like police state. Thank you.
Thank you, caller. No?
Yeah. Well, two parts to that question. The relationship with the Nazis was complicated. I mean, first of all, the U.S. had never really been opposed much to the Nazis, and the British even less so. By the end of the war, the Germans were... The result of the war was being rethought, and there was a picture of Germany in U.S. and Britain that maybe we should be thinking of the next war against the Russians. In fact, the British were more involved in this than we were. By 1944, the British were already withholding intelligence information from the Russians, and beginning to plan for a longer-term operation against the Russians. Only a few years ago, it was released that Churchill had ordered an operation, I think it was called Operation Unthinkable. I think it was around May 1944, right around the time of the German collapse. The idea was to spare the German army and begin preparation for a major attack on Russia using the German army and the British Air Force. Of course, the Americans would get in and so on. They didn't implement it. But as far as the U.S. was concerned, it was less directly involved in this. The U.S. Did rely on the reconstruction of Europe did reinstate plenty of Nazi and fascist collaborators and pretty much destroyed the resistance movement, same in Japan. What you were talking about, U.S. Intelligence and, in fact, the Army counterinsurgency relied pretty extensively on German counterinsurgency practices. The Army carefully studied German counterinsurgency manuals. They were all captured. Wehrmacht officers were brought over to the United States to advise on counterinsurgency. And U.S. counterinsurgency doctrine developed in the 1950s was, in fact, drawing from the Nazi experience. There is very good work on this by Michael McClintock, a former Human Rights Watch analyst, a couple of good books. Instruments of Statecraft is the main one. As for the Military Commissions Act, I mean, that doesn't draw straight from the Nazis, but
could you explain
hard,
what that
hard
is?
To avoid the,
no, yeah. Could you explain what that is for some of our listeners
yeah.
who might not be
familiar? Well, that was the act. A couple of months ago, the Supreme Court outlawed the Bush administration procedures for what amounts to torture. They don't call it that, but they violations of the Geneva Convention. The court determined that the U.S. is bound by the Geneva Convention, contrary to what the Bush administration claimed. Bush had declared that he has the constitutional authority to override the Geneva Conventions against torture, taking of prisoners, and not granting them basic rights, and so on. Well, the court ruled that out. Then came a debate in Congress in which McCain and a couple of others sort of postured a bit about how they were going to insist on decent treatment, but then a law was finally passed, the Military Commissions Act, which essentially gave Bush all he wanted. It said the president has the authority to determine who will be taken and declared enemy combatant, you know, somebody we can pick up, denied the right of habeas corpus. That rescinds rights that go back to the 13th century, subjected to any treatment that the president determines is legitimate. And furthermore, it went on to revise the U.S. War Crimes Act. One of the things that the administration was worried about was that there is an act, the U.S. War Crimes Act, passed by a Republican Congress, 1996, I think, provides serious penalties for anyone in the executive branch who is guilty of breaches of the Geneva Conventions, in fact, up to the sentence of death for grave breaches. And the administration has been worried about that. Attorney General Gonzales, then Bush's legal advisor, had advised him in a memorandum that leaked a couple of years ago that he'd better somehow rescind the Geneva Conventions to ward off the threat of prosecution. Well, Congress took care of that in the Military Commissions Act by exempting high officials from the War Crimes Act retrospectively, so they're now exempt from any charges from the past. Torture, incidentally, is the least of it. The invasion of Fallujah, for example, was a vast breach of the Geneva Conventions, taking over a hospital, kicking the patients out of their beds and throwing them on the handcuffing them on the floor and so on. I mean, these are extreme violations. They are, in fact, subject to the death penalty. So that's all rescinded. It is a little bit ambiguous about American citizens. It does allow the government to pick them up without charges, hold them indefinitely. They may have the right of appeal to a court, depending how you interpret the legislation. But it is an absolutely shocking legislation.
Do you think the caller, I think, was also sort of saying, with that, are we moving in the United States toward more of a police state with less legal protection from state harassment, with less respect for traditional civil liberties than has been the case in the past 30 or 40 or 50 years in most of our lifetimes?
It's a very bad move. It's certainly a regression, but I wouldn't exaggerate. I mean, this can be combated and overturned. And there have been periods of American history where the repression was far worse. It's not to absolve the current administration or Congress, but you go back to, say, Wilson's Red Scare, Woodrow Wilson, the great idealist. His Red Scare at the end of the Second World War and after was much worse than this. That was probably the worst period of repression.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And country recovered and can recover from this.
Our guest, Noam Chomsky. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580, coming to you live today, December 3rd, 2006. 1 week from today, our guest will be Mark Weisbrot, who's been a frequent guest, talking about politics in Latin America, media coverage of Latin America, and business journalism and economics journalism right here in the United States and the future of our economy. 2 weeks from today, our guest will be Howard Zinn, the historian who's also been a frequent guest here at Media Matters, talking about politics and history and some of the stuff we're probably talking about today with Noam Chomsky. We have one more caller who's been patiently waiting. I want to get to the phone line with that person right away. Line 2, Eureka, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Noam Chomsky.
Thank you very much. It's indeed an honor. My question is, with the recent elections and the Democrats in control of Congress, what effect do you think they might have on the Iraq war, and what specific steps do you see as the most effective by the general public in continuing the pressure to end this debacle in Iraq?
Well, my own rather gloomy guess is that the small victory of the Democrats probably isn't going to change very much, not internationally. They don't have any. They're not a genuine opposition party. You can barely find out what their position is. My guess is that on domestic issues, they'll soften the harsh edges a bit. So like they may block, I hope they will block the Bush attempt to dismantle the very successful Social Security system and to undermine the health system even more than the disaster that it is and so on. On that, they ought to be able to do some things. But on international affairs, they're just not that different. And in fact, your question about the pressures on them is just the right one. What should we do to get them out of there? Well, the first thing we have to do is face up to the realities. It is not a technical matter of withdrawing troops. Anybody can figure out how to do that. The Pentagon can do that in a month if the decision comes. The question is, are we going to deal with the fact that for U.S. planners, a sovereign and independent Iraq could turn into a nightmare, not for you and me, but for the interests of the planners? Unless we're willing to face that question, honestly, the pressures on the talk about withdrawal is not really getting to the heart of things. We also have to face the fact that the responsibility of an invading army, I mentioned this before, is to pay attention to the will of the victims. That's crucial. You know, it may not be the only consideration, but it's crucial. And we know pretty well what it is. The U.S. government and the British government are carrying out regular polls in Iraq. According to the latest polls, according to the latest State Department poll, two-thirds of the people of Baghdad want the U.S. forces out immediately. According to these and other polls over the whole country, a huge majority want a firm timetable for withdrawal within a year or less. Even the Kurdish areas, which is interesting because there's practically no army up there. That's the population of Iraq. What's the response of the Bush administration and commentators and the media? Well, the response of the Bush administration is no timetable for withdrawal. We don't care what you think. The response of commentators is Bush is dedicated with all his heart to the mission of bringing democracy to Iraq, except we're not going to pay any attention to your opinion. Well, you know, those are things that the protest movement should be focusing on, as well as on the horrible catastrophe that's being caused, which brings up another responsibility of invading armies, and that is to pay reparations for what they've done. Now, that includes not only the invasion, which is horrible enough, but 10 years of sanctions, U.S.-UK sanctions, which killed hundreds of thousands of people, devastated the country, essentially kept Saddam in power. And then there's 10 years before that. I mean, we don't like to we have to bring this up. Right now, Saddam Hussein was condemned to death for crimes he committed in 1982. Well, interesting year. 1982 was the year when Ronald Reagan removed Iraq from the list of terrorist states so the U.S. could begin supplying Saddam with plenty of aid, including means to develop weapons of mass destruction. He sent Donald Rumsfeld there, his special emissary, to fix up the deal. And so it continued. Chemical weapons, means to develop nuclear weapons, and so on. It goes right through the worst atrocities, the Halabja massacre, the Anfal massacres of the Kurds. Goes on after the war with Iran was over. Didn't have to do with the war with Iran. And George Bush the First explained why. Said it's our duty to American exporters to help them export to Saddam. And besides, he's contributing to the stability of the region. I mean, in 1989, the first Bush administration invited Iraqi nuclear engineers to the United States for training on how to develop nuclear weapons. In 1990, just a couple of April 1990, a couple of months before the invasion of Kuwait, George Bush sent a senatorial delegation led by Bob Dole, Senate Majority Leader, later Republican presidential candidate, to convey his greetings to Saddam, his good wishes, to inform him that he shouldn't pay attention to criticism he reads in the American press occasionally, and so on. In fact, after the Gulf War, the U.S. returned to supporting Saddam. There was a Shiite uprising, which probably would have overthrown him. The Bush administration had total control of the area. It effectively authorized Saddam to use aircraft, military helicopters, heavy equipment to crush the rebellion, killing thousands, tens of thousands of Shias, and to stay in power. I mean, these are things, then come the sanctions. I mean, you know, we owe a real debt to Iraq, a major debt. We ought to be paying it, as well as holding those responsible accountable.
So you think the activists in this country, this should be an issue they're raising as part of their organizing?
I think so, absolutely, all the way through.
Our guest today, Noam Chomsky. Noam, we've only got about 30 seconds, 45 seconds left, so let me conclude, if I can, just on a short note. What are you working on now? What does your schedule look like for the coming year?
Pretty much the same things, the things we've been talking about, lots of others. I just got back from Latin America. I've been working a lot on things there. But primarily the things we're talking about, the threat of nuclear war, environmental disaster. There's very serious domestic problems that have to be dealt with. The country's heading into a fiscal train wreck, consciously. The health system is a total disaster. There's just no shortage of things to deal with.
Noam Chomsky, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they're going to throw me out of the studio in a second. You know, I think I literally could talk to you for the rest of my life without running out of interesting things to hear from you and questions to ask you. I went through 2 out of the 12 things I had on my list. It's just an honor to have you with us today. I know I speak for all my listeners, all our listeners, when we say that. Thank you so much for joining us. Look forward to talking to you soon.
Hope so. Yeah.
I'm Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters here on WILL AM 580. I want to thank Brett Polson, the engineer, Andrew Boyle, my terrific producer who arranged today's show. Please join me 167 hours from now.